Let the spirit of the Kennedys
and the magic of the Disney brothers be with you always.
Blood and Business Legacy merch, available now.
Let's run faster,
work harder,
burn brighter
before we're gone.
Order your Blood and Business Legacy merch today.
Welcome to Blood and Business.
I'm Bethany.
And I'm Cassie.
Today we're telling a story of siblings born and bred to run the world. They were the most infamous family of the 20th century. Their story drips with conspiracy. Their names whispered through the decades since they left their voices echoing in time and space. Their hands helped mold the America we know, sharing with their country dreams of landing on the moon, freedom for every man. And by example, they inspired generations to reach the highest heights. They played with fire, and only a few survived. Their words ring through our history books, their pretty faces on our television screens, and their signature will forever be stamped on our national identity. They stood in the trenches. We stood beside them. They flashed their diamonds. We flashed our cameras. They had their fun, and we saluted them. They were good. They were evil. They were human. They are
the Kennedy siblings.
The Kennedys were one of the most calculated and orchestrated American families ever to live. But their biggest accomplishment was something they never saw coming. JFK was never meant to be president. There was another heir to the Kennedy throne. He was smarter, a better speaker, a better leader, more athletic, and more popular. But fate reached down with her bitter hand and changed the Kennedy story forever. Today we're going back in time, to the fall of 1933. Joe Jr. had graduated from Harvard with his bachelor's degree and moved on to law school, and Jack blossomed. With Joe Jr. and his sparkle dust gone, Jack was left more confident, to the point that even his grades started to improve.
That's interesting because it's kind of the opposite of what happened when they were kids, when Joe Jr. went off to Choate for the first time and Jack hadn't attended yet. His grades started plummeting.
Yeah, because he was left at home without his big brother. But now it's like you can see him coming more into himself because the absence of his incredible big brother, instead of being
like depressing him.
Right. Or like him losing that stability. It's like he has his own stability and he's able to like shine even further.
Right. He was able to rise to the occasion almost.
Jack even began to occasionally write for the Harvard School newspaper and made a speech before the YMCA and YWCA on how to restore peace. In the fall of 1939, Jack's interest in political affairs manifested in his schoolwork. Quote,
"The war clinched my thinking on international relations. The world had to get along together."
He wrote his thesis on how Great Britain got itself into World War II and what decisions led up to the disaster. He concluded that the popular vote does not always make for the best policy. And pretending that there are no hostile world dangers does not disarm the evil people that do, in fact, exist. Interesting stance for a president of a democracy. And maybe this is why he did not mess around with Castro. Maybe this is why he almost had him assassinated. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. That is a story for another episode. Jack didn't have groundbreaking ideas, but people were hungry for a voice to match their own thoughts. He ended up compiling his thesis into a book and publishing it, which actually wasn't a common thing for a Harvard undergraduate to do. It wasn't a great paper or a great book, but the publisher agreed because Jack was the son of Joseph P. Kennedy, who was still the ambassador to Great Britain at the time. Also, I would like to highlight again just how freaking well off these Kennedy kids were. Jack used typists and stenographers to help him meet his university deadlines. How freaking nice. I need a video editor and a stenographer. Stat, please. Although maybe it wasn't the Kennedys per se. Maybe it was just Jack Kennedy, because this irritated and infuriated no one more than Joe Jr. According to a friend of Joe Jr. during his Harvard Law School days, Tom Bilodeau, Joe Jr. was, quote,
increasingly overwhelmed academically and increasingly jealous. Joe told me once that he thought Jack had some sort of lucky charm, but he said the luck wouldn't last forever and Jack would be sunk in the long run once genuine effort was called for. He was clearly disapproving of Jack's relaxed attitude and at the same time envious of how Jack's successes tended to pile up despite Jack's casual approach.
That is such the perfect older child versus the wild middle child.
Joe Jr. was for sure the tryhard. And it was actually Joe Jr. himself who ratted Jack out for relying on others' help to get his thesis done.
Of course it was. Because he's like, if I'm trying this hard, you have to too.
We literally only know that Jack used stenographers because Joe Jr. wrote to their father, quote,
Jack rushed madly around last week with his thesis and finally, with the aid of 5 stenographers, the last day, got it in under the wire. I read it before he had it finished up, and it seems to represent a lot of work, but did not prove anything.
Hey, Dad, just so you know, I'm working harder than Jack, and he doesn't deserve credit.
Hey, Mom, this is Kik. Just so you know, Rose is as fat as ever.
No. I have gained a few pounds, but Rose is as fat as ever.
Despite the lack of genius in Jack Kennedy's book, the timeliness of it appealed to millions of Americans looking for a wise response to the war.
Okay, so to just put this into perspective a little bit, Jack is in undergrad still. So he's like in his early 20s and already putting himself out there, writing a book, publishing it, having like common folk read it, but also getting feedback from mentors.
Yeah, and paying attention to politics, trying to really understand what's going on. And Joe Jr. is giving him, you know, a little credit, but not a lot. But he definitely was reaching for the stars, I feel like, already when he's 20 years old. And like, who is Jack Kennedy?
Yeah, nobody. He's taking the initiative for sure.
Also keep in mind, at this point, this is still just a European war. The United States had not been attacked at Pearl Harbor, and we had not entered the battle yet.
Even more than it was hard work, it was just brave to put your ideas out there like that. He had like kind of no room to talk because he's this young kid. He's still an undergrad, but he has already been exposed to parts of the war and has already traveled abroad with Lem. He has been around his dad being ambassador of Great Britain. So he has had some personal experience.
The book received outstanding reviews and incredible sales in the United States and Britain and showed that Jack had what it took for a public career. He wasn't actually considering running for any office at this point, but the success of the book suggested that it may be possible for him to have a career in politics in the near future. Neither Jack nor Joe Sr. were thinking president of the free world quite yet, but Joe Sr. was really proud of Jack's accomplishments and thought he did a swell job on his thesis. Joe Sr. wrote to Rose, quote,
there is no question that regardless of whether he makes any money out of it or not, he will have built himself a foundation for his reputation that will be of lasting value to him.
In the summer of 1940, aside from promoting his book, Jack had absolutely no idea what he was doing. He thought about attending Yale Law School, but his health issues convinced him that it wasn't a good idea. He was already not very sure about a law career because it would mean competing with his big brother, Joe Jr., who was already enrolled at Harvard Law School at this time. Lem Billings said, quote,
I don't think there was any question but that he was thinking he would go into journalism and teaching. But there was an awful vacuum there in 1940. Very uncomfortable for a guy who was graduating from school. I mean, what to do? We were so damn close to going to war. You didn't know what you were going to do, so what was the point of getting into any lifelong thing?
I definitely think that's how COVID graduates felt.
You were a COVID graduate. That's how you felt. So like we said, in the summer of 1940, Jack didn't know what he was going to do with his life. So he just kept doing the next right thing and doing what he could where he was, contributing what he had to give at each moment, and he grew and he got bigger. He collected memories, perspectives, and experiences, and when he could, he shared them. He built his confidence by doing. He ended up enrolling in Stanford. He figured he could nurse himself back to health in the California sun and get started on a graduate degree in business studies at the same time. And this is also the first time that Jack was involved in real politics. Joe Sr. resigned from his role as ambassador, and Jack helped him decide what to say to distance himself from Prime Minister Chamberlain's failed policies leading up to World War II. On December 7th, 1941, Japanese U-boats attacked the United States at Pearl Harbor off the coast of Hawaii just before 8 in the morning. Joe Jr. didn't want to go to war. He was his father's son. But even before the attack on Pearl Harbor, he could see that war was obviously unavoidable and decided that he wanted to be on the front lines to protect his country that he hoped he may eventually lead from the Oval Office. Quote,
I have become one of Roosevelt's several million numbers, and service, I think, might suit me best. Perhaps the Navy Air Corps. I've always fancied the idea of flying, and I've never fancied the idea of crawling with a rifle and bayonet through the European mud.
Because Joe Jr. was still in his second year of law school at Harvard, the U.S. draft regulations gave him the option to enlist in the Naval Reserve so that he would have time to finish school before shipping off. He instead chose to override the pass, left before his final year of Harvard Law School, and enlisted as active duty at 26 years old. Here's the letter he wrote to his dad to explain.
I think, in that Jack is not doing anything, and with your stand on the war, that people will wonder what the devil I am doing back at school with everyone else working for national defense. As far as the family is concerned, it seems to me that Jack is perfectly capable to do everything. If, by chance, anything happens to me.
It sounds egotistical, but you have to remember that the public kind of was looking to the Kennedy family to do something. They almost looked to them to like know how to react themselves in a way. And the Kennedy family was in the news a lot. So whatever their reaction was, it would be documented and like told to everyone. So I think that Joe Jr. felt a lot of pressure from obviously his family because he states in the letter that his dad's not doing anything about it and Jack's not doing anything about it. So he definitely feels pressure to do something himself.
For his family and for his family's name in the public.
It wasn't totally self-serving though, because he literally states in this letter as well that I might die.
Yeah. And he was okay with that.
Yeah, he thought it was important enough to go anyways.
As you may have guessed, Joe Jr. flew right to the top of his class in flight school, just as he had done in every classroom and competition since he was born. Here's one of his instructors. Quote,
Naval flight instruction was demanding, but some cadets took to it more naturally than others. Kennedy was a natural. After months of ground school, he flew with an instructor over Jacksonville, Florida, in a two-seat single-engine primary trainer for an extended period from mid-November 1941 until December 9th, before his instructor finally decided that his student was ready to solo.
The fact that this decision was made just 2 days after the United States was attacked on home soil may have been a factor. He earned his wings in May 1942, flew patrols in the Caribbean, and then in January of 1943 was deployed to Europe at 27 years old. Now let's circle back and catch up with Jack. He started at this point to have some serious back problems that would play a major role in his life, and at almost the same time, at the age of 23, was among the first men inducted into the U.S. Army for World War II. Because he was enrolled at Stanford for the 1940 through 1941 school year, he wasn't called into service until the end of the academic year. A Harvard friend wrote to him and said, quote,
The only humorous thing in my life to date has been you getting drafted. I swear to God, Jack, I thought I'd die of exhaustion from laughing. Christ, of all the guys in the world,
It's a lucky thing you've got your stomach.
Just a bit honest. The crazy thing is, Jack's health issues were so bad that it would have given him an automatic easy out of the draft. But he wanted to serve, and he did everything he could to hide his health issues. Quote,
"This draft has caused me a bit of concern,"
he wrote Billings.
"They will never take me into the army. And yet, if I don't serve, it will look quite bad."
In 1941, Jack failed the physical tests for the Army and the Navy, so he enlisted his father's help to pull some strings and get him in. He followed a strict workout routine the entire summer, but exercise wasn't going to solve the reasons that he wasn't accepted. He had to get his medical history omitted. And what do you know? Magically, 1 month later, the Board of Medical Examiners gave Jack a clean bill of health. He entered the Navy in October 1941 and immediately was sent to the Foreign Intelligence Branch in Washington. He was a paper pusher. So in order to entertain himself with such a boring day job, he picked up quite the social life. At this point, Kick was a reporter for the Times-Herald newspaper. Remember her asking around about the lobotomies for Rosemary?
This is 1941, so this is the year that Rosemary got the lobotomy, and the family was a bit distracted with the World War.
So because of Kick's job, and of course because of her personality, she knew a ton of people and was instantly able to plug Jack into a network of friends. And it was through her that Jack met a girl named Inga Arvid.
Inga Binga.
She was blonde with blue eyes and, quote,
exuded sexuality.
She was 4 years older than Jack, twice married, and was a daily columnist at the Times-Herald where Kathleen worked. She told a coworker at the time that she found Jack refreshing because, quote,
he knows what he wants. He's not confused about motives.
She was actually still married to her second husband, but they were separated. And she and Jack began their relationship with the mutual understanding that they were only a fling to each other. Quote,
I wouldn't trust him as a long-term companion, obviously. And he's honest about that. He doesn't pretend that this is forever, so he's got a lot to learn, and I'll be happy to teach him.
The thing about Inga, though, Joe Kennedy thought she might be a Nazi spy. Jack and Inga tried to keep the relationship a secret by always going out on double dates with Kathleen and her boyfriend, aka Kick. But Jack's affair was an open secret. Joe Sr. kept tabs on everything his children did. He had eyes and ears everywhere. He didn't object to Jack's involvement with Inga, though, so long as it remained nothing more than a fling. But before long, in spite of his intentions to keep everything casual, Jack found himself falling in love with Miss Inga Binga, as he called her, and she felt the same. Quote,
he had the charm that makes birds come out of their trees. When he walked into a room, you knew he was there. Not pushing, not domineering, but exuding animal magnetism.
But the stars were not aligned. Their growing feelings were an issue for both of them. Obviously, Joe and Rose would not have their son in a serious relationship with a divorced woman, let alone a non-Catholic. And then, information started to come out that Inga had been given privileged access to Nazi higher-ups, including Hitler himself. She had gone to Germany to report on the war and everything going on in 1941, and when she came to America to earn a journalism degree at Columbia, the FBI started tracking her movements. And now her affair with Jack raised their suspicions even more. It also worried the government that Jack might be a potential weak link in naval security, and there were questions about whether or not he should be dismissed from duty.
For clarity, they did not think that Jack was going to be helping the Nazis on purpose. They just thought that he was a young, stupid kid in love and might accidentally say something to his girlfriend that he wasn't supposed to.
Instead of dismissing him, the Navy transferred him to a desk job at the Charleston Navy Yard in South Carolina to create some distance between the two of them. Quote,
They shagged my butt down to South Carolina because I was going around with a Scandinavian blonde and they thought she was a spy.
He kept up with her through letters and phone calls for about 2 months after being transferred down to Charleston. He was incredibly unhappy about it because of Inga, but also because his new position seemed like a waste of time. Inga went to Charleston a few times to spend long weekends, but the FBI wiretaps and the disapproval from Joe and Rose ended up getting between them. Inga was worried about being pregnant at one point and accused Jack of
taking every pleasure of youth, but not the responsibility.
Sounds like Jack.
I mean, what do you expect? You literally said that. She talked about getting her marriage annulled at one point, and Jack responded that he, quote,
had very little comment to make on the subject.
He ended the relationship in early March 1942.
Jack hears one thing about marriage. He's like, all right, I'm out.
You obviously are getting a bit confused here. So we need a bit of clarity. So he ended the relationship in March 1942. And Inga agreed, stating, quote,
there is one thing I don't want to do, and that is harm you. You belong so wholeheartedly to the Kennedy clan, and I don't want you to ever get into an argument with your father on account of me.
She said that if she was younger, she would fight for them to stay together, but that she was wiser now. Historians think that maybe she was also richer. That maybe Joe Kennedy paid her to walk away. Jack thought about renouncing his Catholic faith as revenge against his parents for basically forcing him to end things with Inga, but his loyalties to his faith and his parents were stronger than his rebellious streak. Also, I would like to note that his form of renouncing his faith and rebelling against the Catholic Church and against his mother was going to be the idea of hosting a Bible study. Apparently, that is a very non-Catholic thing to do. In July 1942, the Navy approved Jack's request for sea duty, and so he went to midshipman school in Chicago. This is what he said about it. Quote,
this GD place is worse than Choate, but as FDR always says, this thing is bigger than you or I. It's global, so I'll string along.
Jack's goal in becoming active sea duty was to be a patrol torpedo commander, or you may have heard people use PT for short. The papers were always publishing stories about the heroes that worked on them, and so Jack needed to get on one. Being a PT captain was really physically demanding, and Jack's back issues were so severe that he doubted he would ever be accepted, but he went ahead and applied anyway. And he asked his dad to intervene for good measure. The positive publicity that Jack, the former ambassador's son, would bring persuaded the military to give Jack one of only 50 spots available out of over 1,000 volunteers. He was also afraid that he wouldn't be able to survive the physical portion of the training required, so he put himself through his very own Jack Kennedy's boot camp. Quote,
he was in pain.
A bunkmate of Jack's remembered.
He was in a lot of pain. He slept on that dang plywood board all the time, and I don't remember when he wasn't in pain.
Rose wrote to her other children, quote,
his whole attitude about the war has changed. He is quite ready to die for the USA in order to keep the Japanese and Germans from becoming the dominant people on their respective continents. He also thinks it would be good for Joe Jr.'s political career if he, Jack, died for the grand old flag. Although, I don't believe he feels that it is absolutely necessary.
Which is funny, you could say, because clearly they're his parents. They were relieved that he didn't think it was, quote unquote, absolutely necessary, but they also didn't think what he said was completely insane, which it was, to die for someone's political career. Joe Sr. told their priest that Jack's decision to enter combat in the PTs was, quote,
causing his mother and me plenty of anxiety.
He was proud of his sons for entering the most dangerous branches of the military.
But it was causing quite a measure of grief.
It's so eerie considering what actually did end up happening.
Joe Sr. tried to keep Jack safe by holding him back in Rhode Island as a PT instructor for 6 months to a year. But quickly, Jack figured out something was going on and he went straight to his lieutenant to demand he get out to the war zone. His lieutenant insisted that he stay, and so Jack called in good old Honey Fitz for help. Grandpa Fitz arranged a meeting with the senator of Massachusetts, who was impressed with Jack after their meeting and subsequently sent a letter to the Navy. So here are my points with all of this. First, it shows you just how much power and access these people had at their fingertips. And second, it gives a glimpse into Jack's mind and gives a better look at who these people were. Because this much determination and eagerness to go off to combat and be in such a dangerous war zone consistently from both Joe Jr. and Jack needs some explanation. I grabbed an excerpt from Robert Dallek's book, John F. Kennedy, An Unfinished Life. Quote,
was it because he felt invincible, as the young often do, especially the privileged? This seems doubtful. The reality of war casualties had already registered on him. Your friend Jock Pitney, Jack wrote to Lim on January 30th, 1943, I saw the other day is reported missing, and a classmate of mine, Dunk Curtis, was killed on Christmas Day. Was Jack then hoping for a war record he could use later in politics? Almost certainly not. In 1943, Joe Jr. was the heir apparent to a political career, not his younger brother. Instead, his compelling impulse was similar to that of millions of other Americans who believed in the war as an essential crusade against evil, an apocalyptic struggle to preserve American values against totalitarianism. One wartime slogan said it best. We can win. We must win. We will win.
Quote,
I'm extremely glad I came,
he wrote to Inga.
I wouldn't miss it for the world, but I will be extremely glad to get back. A number of my illusions have been shattered.
He wrote about seeing brother soldiers die right in front of him. And his 17 months over there changed his perspective quite a lot.
Remember from the Bouvier episodes that Jackie went over there right after the war and saw the effects of it on France, and it changed her perspective completely.
Changed her whole life, I feel like.
Yeah, that's sort of what made her want to go into the political realm and journalism. And Jack is seeing it happen real time, so I can't imagine how much that changes you and the way that you think throughout the rest of your life.
Quote,
the boys at the front talked first and foremost about when exactly they were going to get home.
And this next quote from Jack really hit home for me what he and everyone else over there were going through.
He was critical of the politicians and leaders commenting about the war from the safety of U.S. soil. He said, quote,
the only people who want to be out here are the people back in the States. All the talk about billions of dollars and millions of soldiers made thousands of dead sound like drops in the bucket. But if those thousands want to live as much as the 10 I saw on my boat, they should measure their words with great, great care.
This brings us to an event that I had heard little snippets and rumors about, but here's the real story. Jack being a war hero. So it all started when his PT was rammed and sunk by the Japanese. Jack's boat was the only PT ever hit like this in the entire war. Obviously, this made people question whether it was his fault or not, but it wasn't. It was the military's protocols that put him and his men in danger. They were sitting in one spot in the water, and so to make it less likely that they get seen by the enemy, the Navy taught them to only have one engine running, because it would reduce the amount of churning water that could be seen and make it easier to hide. It was great in theory until they were spotted and couldn't get away fast enough because their engines were not running. The other problem was that only 4 of the 15 boats out there had radar. And since it was pitch black at night, it was impossible for the other 11 PTs that didn't have it to follow the other US boats or to see the Japanese coming. They were sitting ducks.
So Jack did get special privileges, but once he was over there, he was treated like everyone else. He wasn't one of the ones who got radar on his boat, and
he wasn't put in a specially safe situation. He was just fighting for his country like everybody else. They saw the Japanese destroyer coming, and then 10 to 15 seconds later, were rammed from the side. The PT sank slowly, So four of the men held onto the hull of the boat, which was still floating, and then Jack and two other soldiers swam out to go get the other five survivors and lead them back to the floating debris. Some of the men were seriously burned, and so Jack took three or four trips swimming out and dragging them back against the current. Two of the men were instantly killed in the collision and were never found. After 9 hours of clinging to the floating hull, it started to sink. Jack organized the survivors into two groups for a swim to a 70-yard-wide, tiny little island. He pulled the boat's engineer, who was badly burned, behind him in the water by putting his life jacket ties in his mouth, clenching them in his teeth, and then swam on his stomach, dragging the soldier behind him. The swim took 5 hours of straight swimming, and Jack hadn't slept in 36 hours. And just so you know, I'm not going to keep coming back to Jack's medical health in every chapter of his life extensively, but remember, through everything that goes on, he is already in massive pain, just at his resting place. His Navy medical record noted, quote,
"Jack's general health has always been good. Appendectomy in 1932, no serious illnesses."
But in reality, he was hiding massive stomach, colon, and back problems that he was self-medicating by taking steroids every day. And that ended up causing a deterioration of his bones and arthritis issues. Okay, so back to the wreckage in the ocean. Remember, Jack is the PT captain. He's the one in charge and responsible for these men's lives. Jack dropped everyone off at the island and then decided to swim out to a nearby passage where he could flag a boat down. But no one came that night, so he swam back to the island while he passed in and out of consciousness. The men who were with him say it was about an hour each way to that passage from the little island. He was too tired to make another trip that night, so he sent another crew member, but he didn't see any boats either. They had no drinking water other than a few raindrops that they could catch in their mouth, so they decided to swim to a larger nearby island, but they still didn't find any fresh water. 2 days later, two of the men swam with Jack to another island, where they finally found a one-man canoe and a big 55-gallon drum of fresh water and some crackers and candy. These supplies may have been stashed by a country's military in case someone got stranded like this, because these islands were in a war zone. Jack carried the water and food in the canoe back to where the rest of the men were, and they actually had been discovered by two native islanders who were helping them survive on coconuts. One of the men scratched a message onto a rock and sent it with one of the native islanders, who then carried the message to a New Zealand infantry unit who was working with the U.S. Army, and within 24 hours, they were all aboard a new PT and headed for medical attention. Jack became a media sensation. Not because he was one of the only heroes in the war, and also not just because of who he was. There were tons of other stories of men doing incredible things, but the journalists were highlighting Jack specifically because he was a unifying example. His story showed the country that it was not only ordinary people from the Midwest out there risking their lives, but also the privileged and wealthy. Someone who had voluntarily placed himself in harm's way and stepped up to the plate when disaster struck. Quote,
"None of that hero stuff about me,"
he wrote to Inga.
"The real heroes are not the men who return, but those who stay out there, like plenty of them do. Two of my men included."
Once, a skeptic asked Jack how he became such a hero, and Jack replied, quote,
"It was easy. They cut my PT boat in half."
Jack is literally just trying to keep himself and his men alive, and people are questioning if this whole thing is a PR stunt.
And then the real tragedy struck. In the summer of 1944, Joe Jr. was flying back and forth over the English Channel, and although he had been given permission to go home after 30 missions, he insisted that he stay in combat at least through D-Day to help guard against German U-boat attacks. a fellow soldier remembered about Joe Jr. Quote,
"When I tried to make casual conversation, I got the positive impression that I was talking about firecrackers to a man valiantly trying to perfect the atom bomb before an impossible deadline."
Another pilot who served with him, Louis Pappas, remembered, quote,
"There was never an occasion for a mission that meant extra hazard that Joe did not volunteer. He had everybody's unlimited admiration and respect for his courage, zeal, and willingness to undertake the most dangerous missions."
Yes. I feel like that quote sums up how I feel about the Kennedys in general.
Yeah.
Everyone who was close to them and active in their real life, well, I shouldn't say everyone, but the overwhelming majority,
yes,
thought that they stepped up to the plate time and time again when they didn't have to, when it would have made sense not to, when everyone else didn't.
Or was telling them not to.
Yeah, or was giving them advice of like, hey, you shouldn't do this. And next episode, you'll see Bobby do this with his own father.
Mm-hmm. It seems that the people who didn't know them firsthand are the only people saying
they did it out of greed or out of power hunger or whatever. Like, obviously, yes, they were to some extent power hungry, but it's like they wanted the power because they wanted to do something about it. And they, like we've said in past KFMs, they trusted themselves to do what was right. Also, just keep thinking about how old Jack and Joe are here. They're in their younger mid-20s. That's you're a kid still.
Yeah.
And they are being so freaking brave. And I know that a ton of people were. That also kind of just discourages me about our generation, but...
On August 10th, he had written to Jack about the New Yorker article he saw on Jack's heroism. So he writes to Jack and he's like, "So I saw the article, saw that you're a full-blown war hero, and now am, quote,
much impressed with your intestinal fortitude."
But of course, he was his big brother, and so he also asked,
"Where the hell were you when the destroyer hove into sight? And exactly what were your moves and where the hell was your radar? Congrats on the medal. To get anything out of the Navy is deserving of a campaign medal in itself. It looks like I shall return home with the European campaign medal if I'm lucky."
But 2 days later, while in mid-flight, Joe Jr.'s plane randomly exploded. He wasn't hit. Something happened internally, and he was instantly killed.
I don't know why that fact makes it even more eerie, but it freaking does.
So crazy. Joe Jr. knew that this mission was especially dangerous. If it had been successful, it would have been one of the top three accomplishments of World War II. And of course, as soon as he heard about it, he went straight to his commanding officer, James Reedy, to request his spot in the cockpit. Reedy was reluctant, but he approved the appointment because he believed Joe Jr. was his best pilot and his best bet. The JFK Library cites this order of events, according to a fellow pilot. Quote,
"The airplane was in flight, with routine checking of the radio controls proceeding satisfactorily. When at 6:20 p.m. on August 12, 1944, two explosions blasted the drone, resulting in the death of its two pilots. No final conclusions as to the cause of the explosions has ever been reached."
Joe Jr. wrote to his parents on July 26th, the day after his 29th birthday. Quote,
"I'm going to do something different for the next 3 weeks. It is secret and I am not allowed to say what it is, but it isn't dangerous, so don't worry."
His dad wrote back, quote,
"I can quite understand how you feel about staying there, but don't force your luck too much."
Joe Jr. told a friend just before he took off, quote,
"If I don't come back, tell my dad that I love him very much."
I don't know why that one freaking gets me, dude. Ugh.
Because, like, one thing is dying and not seeing it coming, and another is just knowing it's coming for you.
And walking forward anyway.
Mm-hmm.
According to a 1987 Washington Post article by Doris Kearns Goodwin, quote,
"It was early Sunday afternoon in Hyannisport when the message reached the Kennedy family at their big white house at the breakwater. There was a knock at the front door, and when Rose answered it, she found two priests, one of whom, a Navy chaplain, Father Francis O'Leary, asked to see Mr. Kennedy. Thinking it was simply a routine matter, Rose invited the priests in and suggested that they join the family for a short time until Joe finished his nap. "No," Father O'Leary said. "This cannot wait. It concerns your son, Joe Jr., who is missing in action." Rose ran upstairs and burst into her husband's room, waking him. She stood for a few moments, her mind half paralyzed, trying to speak but stumbling over her words. Then she managed to blurt out what the two priests had said. Joe Sr. rushed down and escorted the priests into a small room off the living room. There, he and Rose heard the story that made it clear that there could be no hope. Their eldest son was dead.
When Joe Sr. walked out of the room, he said, quote,
"Children, your brother Joe has been lost. He died flying a volunteer mission. I want you all to be particularly good to your mother."
Then he turned away, went to his bedroom, and locked the door behind him. Also, according to that article, Rose said that the first few weeks after Joe Jr.'s death were
the blackest hours she had ever known.
And that she, the mother who never showed too much emotion, wept shamelessly at the thought that her son's smiling face and body had, quote,
splintered into 1,000 pieces.
Joe had been the perfect model for all of her kids, always reliable, always working hard at everything he did. Jack was distraught over Joe's death. He coped by writing a memoir for his big brother and called it
As We Remember Joe.
It went out to all the men we lost in World War II. He told Lem after Joe died that his competition with Joe had defined his identity. He also pointed out that now he was permanently going to be inferior in their father's eyes compared to Joe. Quote,
"I'm shadowboxing in a match. The shadow is always going to win. Forever in his father's heart."
According to the Washington Post article, Jack wrote that after Joe Jr. died, he felt, quote,
"terribly exposed and vulnerable."
For 27 years, he had lived with a protective shield, since everything was expected of his older brother. Jack wrote,
"His worldly success was so assured and inevitable that his death seems to have cut into the natural order of things."
Harold Lasky, the socialist that Joe Jr. had studied under in London, wrote to Jack about losing Joe Jr. It sounds like he was attempting to comfort Jack and share fond memories of Joe Jr., but here's how the conversation went. Lasky:
"He was with me during a year when the three outstanding students in my department all happened to be at once socialists and poor Jews from the East End of London. Nothing was more admirable than Joe's attitude toward them. A deep respect for their ability, an ardent promise that one day he would know enough to argue with them on equal terms."
Jack:
"Is that really the way that it was, or are you being generous? It would be surprisingly out of character for him to be at all gracious about not measuring up. He was, at heart, highly competitive, and he usually had but one obvious wish for anyone who showed him up at anything. Destruction."
Kick was also lost without her older brother. We will be able to highlight their relationship more later, but Joe Jr. understood her on a level no one else in the Kennedy family could. And we will discuss that. And then the bitterness of war struck Kick again. Less than a month after Joe Jr. was killed, her husband was killed by a German sniper while fighting in Belgium. She wrote to Jack and said,
"The pattern of life for me has been destroyed. At the moment, I don't fit into any design."
In 1946, the Joseph P. Kennedy Jr. Foundation was established by Joe Sr. and Rose to honor their son. The foundation has since provided funds to the impoverished and now aims to improve the way the United States treats those who have intellectual disabilities and to help identify ways to prevent the causes of intellectual disabilities.
Thanks to one Eunice Kennedy Shriver.
To Eunice and to Joe Jr., because according to Jack, quote,
"I think if the Kennedy children amount to anything now, or ever amount to anything, it will be due more to Joe Jr.'s behavior and his constant example than to any other factor.
Thanks to Eunice, Joe Jr., Joe Sr., and Rosemary. And if you don't know what we're talking about, you need to go listen to episode 4.
Jack described his brother's death in
As We Remember Joe
as follows.
His squadron, flying in the bitter winter over the Bay of Biscay, suffered heavy casualties, and by the time Joe had completed his designated number of missions in May, he had lost his former co-pilot and a number of close friends. Joe refused his preferred leave and persuaded his crew to remain on for D-Day. They flew frequently during June and July, and at the end of July, they were given another opportunity to go home. He felt it unfair to ask his crew to stay on longer, and they returned to the United States. He remained. For he had heard of a new and special assignment for which volunteers had been requested, which would require another month of the most dangerous type of flying. It may be felt, perhaps, that Joe should not have pushed his luck so far and should have accepted his leave and come home. But two facts must be borne in mind. First, at the time of his death, he had completed probably more combat missions in heavy bombers than any other pilot of his rank in the Navy, and therefore was preeminently qualified. And secondly, as he told a friend early in August, he considered the odds at least 50-50. And Joe never asked for any better odds than that.
Blah. I want to cry.
Joe was awarded the Navy Cross and also the Air Medal. In 1946, the USS Joseph P. Kennedy Jr., destroyer number 850, was launched at Four River Shipyards as the Navy's final tribute to a gallant officer and his heroic devotion to duty. The destroyer USS Joseph P. Kennedy Jr., DD 850, is now at a museum in Battleship Cove, Fall River, Massachusetts. The year before Joe Jr.'s death, his dad said this, quote,
"The measure of a man's success in life is not the money he's made. It's the kind of family he has raised."
Joe Kennedy. Joe Jr.'s family couldn't have been more proud of the person he was growing to be. According to Jack, there was no one he would, quote,
"rather have spent an evening or played golf or in fact done anything with."
Than his big brother, Joe. And then he was gone. Torn from his mom and dad, from his brothers and sisters, and from the life he had ahead. The world will never know what else Joe Jr. had inside him. We know that he would never have stopped his service to his country, and we are grateful for the sacrifice he and so many others gave during World War II. By the way, Joe, we won. We did it.
They were at the helm during the most turbulent moment in American history. The rumors are legion. Some sincere, some slander. They gave everything to their country. But what did it look like behind closed doors, in their homes? The most intimate moments of their time on Earth. Sometimes the truth is more wild than the headlines. They seemed to live the easy life, but they lost it all in an instant. They ran faster, worked harder, burned brighter, and then they were gone. You have just listened to The Kennedy Siblings, Episode 6. From Blood and Business.
Thank you all for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed it, please give us a review on Apple, rate us on Spotify, and share Blood and Business with a friend or a sibling. If you'd like to support the show, the best way is to become a patron of Blood and Business. You will get bonus content every month, including a monthly bonus episode, interactive main episodes, and behind-the-scenes footage.
To keep up with us day-to-day, you can follow us at Blood and Business on Instagram and TikTok. You can find the link for Instagram, TikTok, and Patreon in the show notes below. Thank you so much for the support, and we will see you back here next week for your regularly scheduled programming on
Blood and Business.
The main source for this episode was An Unfinished Life, John Fitzgerald Kennedy by Robert Dalek, and Kick by Paula Byrne. To see a complete list of sources for all Blood and Business episodes, head on over to Patreon for a free PDF download.
And I'm
absolutely stopping. Oh my gosh. I was fine until the very end. I was holding his ear. Cassie was not.
I was not.
Because I was like, oh god, if I say something, it's like when you say, are you okay?
And don't
like,
ask me how I am. I will explode.
That is so.
I was literally fine until the. By the way,
Joe, I know that freaking we gets won. Me too.
By the way, Joe,
because it's so heavy,
we won, and he didn't get to see that.
Yeah.
He
like all the no, not just him, like all the people who
yeah,
sacrificed
obviously
so much and never.
Mm-hmm. I think also like the common name Joe, like makes mm-hmm. it feel like you're telling all those men.
I need to stop talking about this before I ruin my makeup. We have another episode to record. It's just so freaking eerie. And that is like the theme in a lot of the KFMs that like, even, if, you never, even if you never get to see like your legacy or whatever,
it still like matters and it still
changes the course of history.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't take away from the impact that it has.
Okay, I really need to stop because my makeup is pooped. Time and time again, he had an out and he never freaking took it. Like, literally all of them gave until they literally were dead. Like, sacrificed every freaking thing that they had.
It's just, yeah, like, trying to say, by the way, Joe, like, you freaking gave everything.
Yeah, and the fact that he was,
mattered.
Like, yeah, he was white-knuckling. Like, he was aware of how hard, like, it was hard for him. It was
he
a sacrifice.
Go in the first place.
Yeah.
And then he, not only did he go, he
stayed and stayed and stayed.
Stayed because
and it's like that image of like so many people were like went home and then he asked his crew to stay. They stayed longer and then they went home and you can just literally see the people like going back and going back and going back until it's just him.
And how lonely.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like
it would have been so tempting to just go home and be with your family.
Yeah.
You felt, I mean, like, you did your duty, you know?
Yeah, and he knew 50-50. The odds are at least 50-50.